So everything that we've done up to this point has been preparatory for what we're finally going to get into 2 months later or whatever. We have looked at the law. We've looked at love as being the central focus of the law. I mentioned that in the sermon today, that our loving each other is not the law. Not the gospel. That's the law. Love is the law if it's God loving us. Love is the gospel if it's God loving us. But our loving is the law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. The two tables of the law. And we've learned that it's traditionally been the case that the Old Testament law has been separated into three distinct parts. The moral law, the ceremonial law, and the civil law. And the way that people talk about that which has been done away with is usually to say that it's the ceremonial law that's been done away with, although some might say the civil law as well. But then you come to the Ten Commandments, which we looked at, and you come through and you'll find it very popular among some places to hear that nine of the Ten Commandments continue today, but one of them does not. And that's the Sabbath day. That does not continue today. So this kind of opens the door to a troubling idea, because that's the moral law we usually think of. So are we saying that the moral law of God does not always obtain everywhere in every place? So what we're coming today to look at today is some of the difficult parts of the Old Testament law that people don't know what to do with. And it seems arbitrary. Like, why would I pick this one but not the next one as continuing today? And I think I told you guys, I didn't tell you this story, I don't remember. This is one of my more memorable youth pastor lessons that I had, where I went through and I had us read Leviticus 19. And then we just started going through each law. And I said, raise your hand if you think that this one continues today. Half the kids raise their hand, half of them don't. The next one, the other half raise their hand, the other ones don't. Sometimes nobody raises their hand. Sometimes they all raise their hand. It's like, on what basis do you get to say that this one continues and this one doesn't when they're sitting right next to each other? That shows you that there's a big problem, that we don't understand why it is that certain laws continue, certain laws don't continue in their present form, or in their old form in the present day. So I'm going to start by going to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So go to Matthew 5:17. Now this is a remarkable statement. Jesus has just given the Beatitudes. We might put the Sermon on the Mount very simply as this: gospel law. The Beatitudes of the gospel, everything comes after it's the law. If that's the case, then it's presuming that those who are hearing the law are believers. And that this is kind of the third use of the law. But Jesus begins that whole long 2.5 chapters in 5:17, and he says, do not think I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So there's a word abolish in English, and I just wanted to give you some synonyms for it in the dictionary. To abolish can mean to abrogate, to annul, to cancel, to dissolve, to eradicate, to nullify, to overthrow, to put an end to rescind, to revoke, to stamp out, to suppress, to terminate, or to wipe out. You get the point? Now, I'm going to give you two gentlemen who are both Calvinist guys, but they are not covenant theologians. So they're not Reformed. They're what are called New Covenant theologians. And these are the guys who particularly like to say that only nine of the Ten Commandments continue. The Sabbath day does not. D.A. Carson's one of the most quoted writing guys in the evangelical world. Everybody knows him. I have great respect for him. In his commentary on Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount, he says things like this, quote, if oaths, so this is the section on oath taking in the sermon, If oaths designed to encourage truthfulness become occasions for clever lies and casual deceit, Jesus will abolish them. Or he says, certainly on the interpretation adopted here, now he's in Matthew 19 in this section on divorce, Matthew and Mark Luke have this in common. They abrogate any permission for divorce given in Deuteronomy 24:1 if that permission extends or is thought to extend beyond sexual sin. Or he says, at stake are the relation between the testaments, the place of the law in the context of the gospel, and the relation of this pericope to other Old Testament, New Testament passages that unambiguously affirm that certain parts of the law have been abrogated as obsolete. Now, Jesus says, I have not come to abolish the law. And here we have a guy in the very commentary on those sections saying Jesus came to abolish the law. He just uses a different synonym. Another fellow, respect this guy too, good guy, probably heard of him, Fred Zaspel. He says this in a paper that he wrote on New Covenant Theology and the Mosaic Law. He says, the whole of the law may be viewed as being taken up into Christ and given his new authoritative interpretation, with some details of the law, and of the law, the fulfillment will entail extension or even addition. With some details, fulfillment will involve restriction or even abrogation. What he's saying is, sometimes Jesus will take the Old Testament law and add to it. Sometimes he'll take the Old Testament law and get rid of it. And yet Jesus explicitly says, I have not come to abolish the law. It's, guys, it's like saying this. I've not come to abolish the law, but I've come to abolish the law. I don't know how else to say it than that. And it's just terribly unhelpful, in my opinion, in terms of what it does for what we end up thinking about the law in the Old Testament. Now, we could go into the Sermon on the Mount, and my favorite commentary on the Sermon on the Mount with regard to this issue is William Hendrickson in the Giant New Testament Red Volume set that I think we have in our library, and his commentary on Matthew, where he points out that Jesus is not quoting the law and then abrogating it. He's quoting the Pharisees' interpretation of the law and then abrogating it. Totally different things. So if you have more questions on that, highly, highly recommend what he writes in that commentary. It's William Hendrickson. So, what I want us to do is kind of get specific, and I have two or three that are on my mind, and then I have written down a list of things that we can look at, and this is going to have to be an interactive Sunday school. Not that we have problems with that, but this has to be that way, because I've got to get you guys to be thinking, and I'm not going to give you all the answers. In fact, I may not have all the answers for this, because there are some difficult laws in the Old Testament. And I haven't thought about them all. I've studied some of them. So I think I can give you some help on some of them, but I don't know that I can give you help on all of them. But if we can get to the principles that I'm trying to lay down for interpreting the law, I think that will go a long way in helping you understand why a certain law is different than it is today and how it is that it's going away or whatever the case may be. Because nobody disagrees, for example, that we're not supposed to offer sheep anymore in a temple. Why is that the case? Let's stop for a minute and let's go. First of all, if you're offering an animal sacrifice, what kind of law would you call that of the three? Ceremonial law. Have we said that ceremonial law goes away in the New Testament? No. But certain ceremonial laws go away. Why does sacrificing an animal go away in the New Testament?
Because of the sacrifice of Christ.
Okay. Because Jesus sacrifices once for all. But let's go a little deeper. What does John call Jesus when he sees him in the Gospel of John? Behold, the Lamb of God. So you could actually say that animal sacrifice doesn't go away in the New Testament. It's just that there's only one that's needed now, and it has already happened. That's a totally different thing than saying that all animal sacrifices go away. That's not true. Jesus was the lamb that took away our sins. And if that didn't happen, guess what? We'd still be sacrificing animals to this very day. Probably most of us to like Thor and Odin. Just not to Yahweh, because we're Gentiles and we'd be living in darkness. That's exactly right. So the ceremonial law continues today because we make our bodies a living sacrifice. So sacrifices don't stop, but a certain kind of sacrifice stops, which is a sin offering. Thank offering doesn't stop. It transforms. It changes how you do it. You any longer go to the temple to offer a thank offering, but rather you are the temple, and so you offer the thank offering in your own body. So it's fulfillment and learning to think about that. So I want us to start by going to Deuteronomy 25. So everybody go to that passage. I'm going to bring this one up because in the fourth verse, there is a law that Paul quotes not once, but twice. And that verse is verse 4. You shall not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. This is found in 1 Corinthians 9:9 and 1 Timothy 5:18. Now, let's just read this law by itself, verse 4, and you tell me, what kind of a law do you think this is of the three? You shall not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. What kind of a law do you suppose that is of the three?
Civil.
I heard civil. Did I hear anything else?
Moral.
What was that?
Moral.
Why would you say moral, Carl?
I think it addresses the fairness to the animal doing the work and probably at the same time doing the work for the work.
Righteous man taketh care of his animals.
Mm-hmm. I like both of your answers. Because my opinion is that, I think I've showed this, or at least we've talked about it, I believe all civil law has a moral underpinning. I would say that Carl is right insofar as there's a moral principle that never goes away. But Dory's right because I don't have ox anymore. And so what am I going to do with this law? So it's civil in that you live in an old agrarian culture and they're out there with their oxen and they're plowing the field. And the ox is doing the work. Today I would use a tractor and John Deere. It would be more like, don't empty your tank with gas while the tractor is in the field. I mean, it wouldn't be the same. Yeah, don't suck the exhaust. Like, there's not really a moral equivalent with a tractor.
If your tractor falls into a ditch.
That's a different law in Exodus. We'll look at that one later, maybe. Should you pull it out on the Sabbath, right? Okay, so what I want to do is we've looked at that. We've said, all right, this is a civil law that has moral implications. Now, how does Paul apply this?
Pay a pastor.
Pay a pastor. So essentially, he's calling your pastors oxen. Isn't that interesting? What he's saying is that they're plowing a field for you. Uh-huh. And so there's the moral principle is what's being carried over. Obviously, it's not the civil law that's being carried over, unless you actually have a bridle that you put into your pastor's mouth or something and you yank on it when you don't like what he says. Okay, so there's a moral principle that Paul is taking the actual law, and he's not changing what it says, but he's applying it totally differently. That's the key. But have you ever read the laws around it on either side? That's what we're going to do. So there's three laws here. It's the second of the three. First one is the first three verses. The third one is the fifth verse. So we're just going to read these, and then I'm going to stop. Well, I'll read them all together, and then I'll let you think about it. What kind of a law are they? We'll talk about this. If there's a dispute, this is verse 1 of chapter 25. If there's a dispute between men, and they come into court, and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, then if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, The judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in the presence with a number of stripes in proportion to his offense. 40 stripes may be given him, but not more, lest if one should go on to beat him with more stripes than these, your brother is degraded in your sight. You shall not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Completely different laws, right? And I'm not prepared to comment on why Deuteronomy is doing what it does. I could comment more better on Leviticus. But three totally different laws. So the first law is about people going into a court and having disputes decided. So what would we call this? Moral, ceremonial, or civil?
Civil.
Civil. I mean, you're literally in a civil court, right? Now, is there a moral principle that you see going on here? What would you say is a moral principle?
With the beating, not to give them more than 40.
Okay. So what do you think's going on there?
You're preserving them. You're not.
Yeah. Not going to kill them.
Death.
Right.
Why would the one who was innocent deserve that in the first place? That's an interesting
concept. It's assuming some things here. It's assuming that this particular court has as punishment beating the person for what they've done. Now, you're in the United States of America. Pretty much any time in my lifetime, I cannot remember a court ruling that the guy is convicted and his punishment is to be beaten with a rod, 40 minus one lashes. Here's my point that comes right out of that. We have a society, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong, I'm not making a judgment on that, I don't care at this point. But we have said as a society that beating someone for a crime is not an acceptable form of punishment. They had a society that said beating someone as a crime was an acceptable form of punishment. Theonomists would come along and say, we need to re-implement beating somebody as a crime. Okay? So you're going to have people that will say that, and you'll have other people say, no, I don't think you should do that. And what you're doing is you're arguing about something that's presupposed in this law that isn't actually said is good or bad or not. It's just there. And so what God is doing is he's giving a moral principle to a civil law that undergirds that moral principle, that undergirds how you should go about carrying out that specific civil law. Does that make sense? In other words, if your society has beating, here's the way that it should be developed and run.
Them has a tie to the ox.
I think probably all three of them have a tie to the ox, actually.
Third one's a little harder.
How would you say this is tied to the ox?
Well, these two, it's one don't beat a guy till he dies, and the other one is don't starve the ox.
Uh-huh. Until he dies. What about the third one? Let's look at the third one for just a minute, then we'll have questions and comments.
Well, it kills the name, I guess. It kills the family name.
Okay, so there's some sense in which death is looming over all three of these laws, isn't there? And that means that life is also looming over all three of these laws. That the principle of life has to be taken into account, whatever these three are. And the principle of love your neighbor as yourself as well, because that's the heart of the law. And that would be the heart of the civil law, because it's the second table of the law. Would we call this, what would you call this third one? Would you call it civil or ceremonial or just pure moral?
I think it's moral.
Moral. By moral, do you think that this exact situation should carry out today exactly like that?
But I don't think we're polygamists. And he may have been married to another woman too, so it would be polygamy.
That could be true. So in that case, what I would say is if only the moral principle is to be carried over, then I would say that what we're looking at is either civil or ceremonial, by definition, because it can change from culture to culture, the way that the civil or the ceremonial law is being carried out. But the moral principle never goes away. It always stays the same. It is always wrong, under all circumstances, wherever you're at, to starve your ox while it's working for you. It just is. You're not allowed to violate that. But if you don't have an ox because you have a tractor, then the law is kind of pointless. It doesn't make any sense for your culture. Okay, I've seen a couple of hands. Go ahead, Obert.
One thing my father did that I really will never forget is my sister and I had done something wrong. It was getting near the evening, or after the evening. And whatever we did, he brought us in and said, Albert, would you rather be spanked or spend the rest of the evening in the room? And I said, well, I'd rather be spanked. And as my sister said, well, I'd rather be spending the rest of the evening in the room. So he made me stay in the room and then spanked her.
Did you ever learn to get smart enough to figure out that you could get the opposite if you said the opposite?
But you got prisons filled with people that they would rather have gotten the lashes instead of having to spend years and years in places that are just vile. So I don't think that we have much business looking down our noses at those who do the lashes, because I would, if you had a choice of lashes or prison for 3 years, give me the lashes.
Of course, it depends on the prison. If you got a TV and 3 square meals and carpeting, and a lot of people are going back on purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, Doug, I would imagine that part of the moral principle of that first law would be also if you're an employer to give fair wages so that you're not giving starvation wages to your employees.
Mm-hmm.
I've often thought of this in relation to, not anymore now that servers are getting $20 an hour or whatever, but when they didn't, or if I know that they're getting paid poorly and they depend on tips, if they're serving me, it seems like I'm obligated morally to give them a good tip. So would you say that that also falls in this?
As a moral principle, well, sure. I mean, you're getting back to love your neighbor as yourself is what you're doing.
You actually use DoorDash or some guys do food delivery really good for that.
So
part of why I quit is because like half the people out there didn't tip at all. Or I didn't tip entire cities and go to entire cities because of that.
Doug, I got a question about that first law. When it says that there is a dispute between men, like what kind of dispute are we talking about?
It doesn't matter.
Yes,
it is, because all that matters is that there's a dispute, a judge decides, and then the punishment is that he's beaten.
So, between two men, they come to the court. So I guess it's got to be serious enough that two men felt like they needed to go to the court. But it's almost like it's saying, look, no matter what happens here, guys, one of you's getting beaten. So, you know, I'm trying to understand what it is they're coming to this judge about. And it's got to be something fairly serious, right? Because
you're assuming, yeah, I mean, I would assume so. Especially if we're dealing with the ideal law, and we're assuming that it's okay to beat somebody, which I would say that's a fine assumption, then yeah, it's the judge is deciding, and hopefully he's a righteous judge, that this is what is fair for punishment. It's the beating. So yeah. It doesn't matter. That's not the issue. The issue is when the judge decides, and he decides he has to be beaten, the judge is not allowed to make excessive punishment. Okay? And so that's why this is a principle that's behind a specific example of case law without really getting too specific about what the actual offense might be. Yeah.
So are we talking just, what do they call it, retributive justice, penal punishment, or and what comes to my mind is when we're talking about beatings, spankings, God is redemptive, and things are coming to my mind like Hebrews talks about God chastens us, and it's painful. Sometimes with Proverbs 20:30, by the blueness of a wound, evil is cleansed away. It's redemptive. If we're talking here about Israel was doing that to redeem the man who wronged his brother, the ultimate goal is we want to redeem you, and you haven't listened to the word. Now you're going to listen to the law. It's going to be painful, but we want to redeem you. I understood that our whole child rearing was redemptive, and we spanked, and cultural spanking is like driven out of the whole society now. But what are we talking about here? Why did they do it? And God does it for us children as redemptive, whether it's spiritual, physical, or emotional pain we're brought into. So where are we at with this? Was this a court of redemption, or was it penal? Because God does inflict penal, everlasting punishment on souls, but in this life he does it to change us and cleanse away evil problems, and sometimes with a black and blue wound. And I've spanked my son once, and he had a blue mark, and we're like, oh goodness, they're going to arrest us. Kids got to go to the hospital for it. It scared us. So I just throw that out to think about that law in a big context of why. Why are people so averse to pain beating when it's redemptive? God says he's dealing with us as sons.
So let's talk about this, because one of the things I want to mention is this is a very important point, the distinction between Israel and every other nation that's ever been. They are unique in all of history because they are a theocracy. That's not unique because other nations believe that they were theocracies too. But they're a theocracy that was ruled by King Yahweh. Nobody else ever had that. Sorry, America doesn't have it, never did. The closest you can come is maybe the Pilgrim Plantation with the Mayflower Compact. But that was not God covenanting with us. That was us covenanting with God. It's the other way around. And certainly the United States of America never covenanted with Yahweh. You will look in vain to see Yahweh or Yesu anywhere in our public documents. Doesn't exist. God does, in God we trust. But the question is, all divine counsel people need to know by now is, which God are you talking about? Because I promise you that the God of the Masons is not your God. The God of the deists, not your God. But in God we trust. It's a nice phrase that everybody can kind of read in their own thing. It's Allah. Oh, it's Buddha. Oh, it's the great watchmaker, whatever. It's unoffensive. Yeah, Thomas Jefferson wrote that, and he was a deist. Sure, he believes in an ultimate supreme entity. So did Aristotle. So what? I don't mean that he's worshiping Jesus. But Thomas Jefferson is giving us an eternal moral principle because he lives in God's world, and he can't help but do so. Unless he just wants to completely ignore it like people are today. But Thomas Jefferson didn't want to do that. He believed that all men were created by their creator and down with inalienable rights. That's absolutely true. He just cut out everything about Jesus in his own Bible, literally with the scissors, because he didn't like the man.
I thought I haven't seen the Bible, but I read that he just cut out the miracles.
Yeah, same difference, because he's God. I'm not going to believe in a God that does that, because that offends my God, the God that I've created in my image. It's like worshiping the Father through Baal. You want to put it that way. So if the United States and Israel are totally different, then I want to get to your question a little bit here, Rick, because ideally, I would say that Israel's law code was supposed to be redemptive. That doesn't mean that their law always was redemptive. In fact, probably most of the time it wasn't redemptive because they didn't keep the law. We have perverted views of redemptive laws over here, where we're like, well, we want to rehabilitate the person, so we don't want to do this and this and this to them. We would rather do this and this and this to them. And usually the things that they would rather do are things that are totally contrary to the scripture, because they have a perverted view of who God is and what redemptive activities are. And the last thing I wanted to say was that God sometimes punishes people, and there's no redemptive anything to it. He just punishes them, and they're done. So when we're dealing with civil law, ideally, if you're living in a nation that's a theocracy, you want that law to reflect that. But the fact of the matter is the law itself is cold. It doesn't care one way or the other. And that's why it has to be an individual person's heart, ultimately, that is changed because of what they've done. And God can use that, or he might not use it. Carl, you've had your hand up for a while.
There's a couple things on the table now. I want to get back to the part of this that addresses light and how it undergirds all the moral components we're discussing. But on that last point, we just talked about Israel's perspective. I see most of their laws not as redemptive either. I see them as attempting to be preemptive.
Preemptive, that's interesting. Yeah.
If you do this, okay, then you won't violate this law and mm-hmm. need redemption. And that got them into such a ditch that they carried burdens that were not obligated by God and turned out to be more oppressive.
Let's stop on that for a minute to explain that, because it's a great point. If God's law is in some way preemptive to keep, you know, we'll look at one maybe if we get to it today, of building the fence on your roof. That's kind of preemptive of murder. You want to keep somebody from dying on the top of your house because you're up there all the time. That's preemptive. But I've totally lost my train of thought. So it happens when you get over 50.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about the question a little bit differently. I think when civilization arises out of nothingness, sort of, that the first thing you have to do is bring structure and order to the civilization. And I see some of these Old Testament laws as being oriented more towards the good of society. Although it's quite possible it could be redemptive in a different sense. But if you look at what's going on now, and undoubtedly went on during Noah's time, that orderliness of society deteriorated to the point where it was practically impossible for anybody to be regenerated. And that's why only eight people were on the ark. And if you look at what's going on today, the first thing that happened was they took discipline out of our school system. And so society began to fall apart. And that was one of the things that did it.
Oh my goodness, Janelle had this story this week. She's working in a second grade in the afternoons. And there, it is a nightmare class. Like there are like four or five boys that are just crazy. And they had to get this one boy just completely calmed down. And you're not allowed to touch these kids at all. And they had to send him off to the principal. And so apparently they kind of just did this. And the social justice worker at that school came up to them. And like, they're terrified. Like, are you going to, John's not terrified. Cause he's like, fire me. I don't really care. I don't need this job. But it's that kind of a thing. Like, did you touch him? What did you do to this boy? That's exactly it. I mean, it's completely off the rails. Completely off the rails.
So now we have to start back the other way. And we have to start bringing that orderliness back to society.
And you don't have to go back to Noah. You can go back to King of England and what he was doing to the colonists as what was outlined for us in the Declaration of Independence. So, and that's what they did, is they brought orderliness, which was our constitution, out of disorder. So it is possible to do that. I know what I was going to say, is that, now I just forgot it again. It's like right there, man. It's, well, you were talking about, what were you talking about?
Preemptive.
Okay, stop right there, because I know what it is. It's the Pharisees. It's the Pharisees. The Pharisees were creating a fence around the law because they saw, well, if God was preemptive, we can be even more preemptive. And we can really make sure people won't sin and break the real law. And then that's exactly what you're talking about with this, just burdens that are so unbelievably impossible to carry out. That's exactly right. So.
Well, you're talking about kids that are unruly. I had issues when I was working in school. Like you were saying, I'm just a job code principal, which is that. So I'm moving this one step away from where I was. And principal would be the one judging. So you're just moving the responsibility upward. Responsibility is there.
And then if you get a wicked judge, principal, who refuses to do what they're supposed to do, then you get chaos that ensues.
You get defunded police.
Well, yeah, you get...
They're the bad ones.
Yeah. We'll keep going. Let's go to Numbers 15. This is a famous one. Numbers 15, 32 through 36. This will be interesting to see what you come up with as an answer. Numbers 15, 32 through 36. While the people of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him in custody because it had not been made clear what should be done to him. And the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall be put to death, and all congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, as the Lord commanded Moses. And that's it.
I think 40 lashes would have been good.
So here's what we know. It was the Sabbath day. We also know that the moral law of the Sabbath says what?
No work.
No work. This man was... We also know picking up sticks. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's what's so interesting is he doesn't tell us. People have speculated, well, maybe he was going to make an altar to another god. Or maybe he was just casually walking along the ground and picking up a stick. Depends on which Pharisee you want to ask what they would answer to that question. That's exactly right. It's a definition of sticks. But I don't want to get into that because I simply want us to look at, as we read this, let's categorize where we would put this. And I have a feeling it might be all over the map. How would you categorize this? Is this a civil or ceremonial or moral law?
Yes.
Why would you say all three?
Because I think there's probably some elements of all three.
Name something that would be civil about this, civil law. Okay.
I think it goes to the Sabbath was not made for man, but man for the Sabbath. That's the civil component. That the Sabbath is a rest.
I would say that's the moral component. It's not civil. That's an eternal thing that Jesus talks about. Well, never changes.
When you say civil, I think, what is the...
Let's redefine these. Civil law would be a case law in a culture that's very specific.
Nation's law.
In a nation, yes, in a nation. Ceremonial law would be very specific case law of how a nation is supposed to go about doing something. A moral law would be a principle that is eternal and never changes. Okay, that's how I'm defining them.
Well, the civil law is that they put him in custody.
Yes, and there's more to it than that. They also put him to death. All civil and ceremonial law have moral principles. But it doesn't mean that this is a moral law unless we want to say that every single aspect of this carries over exactly this way today. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm suggesting. Because if we say it's civil law, then you could theoretically come up with some kind of a comparable example that could be implemented in our culture, but it wouldn't look exactly the same. But it would be based on eternal moral principle. You could make that argument. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to say this is a moral law, then that exact case has to be brought over today into our culture. And that's where we go back to the difference between Israel and all other nations. God gave Israel these specific laws as his covenant corporate people so that they would look a very specific way to the nations around them. And the nations were given their own laws by their own gods. And God didn't say anything to them one way or the other about that.
That's interesting, Doug. I remember watching the Ten Commandments, and in that one scene that Charlton Heston's Moses, they said, they've given them a day off. And the Pharaoh says, what is it? It's called the Day of Moses, a law of rest one day, which tells me they did what I saw in Florida. These farm workers work 7 days a week, 6 months. They don't get a day off.
The Egyptians had a Sabbath.
But it was interesting, though, that they said that.
Yeah, that's Hollywood.
Like, what is it? They're mocking the law.
Sure.
And it goes back to maybe what Brendan said, that God gave a day to rest for love and good. And this man, maybe he was just saying, I despise that.
That's exactly what he has to have been saying. But what I said earlier was, how bad must the sin have been? And the answer is, it has to have been very bad,
yeah.
Whatever it was.
He was setting a precedent.
Uh-huh. We've had a bunch of hands up over here, so go ahead, Dory.
Well, I was just reading some of the verses that came before it. So there's some verses about sinning unintentionally, and that certainly doesn't deserve stoning or anything like mm-hmm. that. So we know the man wasn't just like, picking up a stick and going, oh, whoops.
Right, picking up a stick and chucking it like at his dog or something.
But it does say the person who does anything with a high hand reviles the Lord.
Interesting.
Shall be cut.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go.
So it must have been that this man was intentionally flouting God's law.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's why we looked at the, I'm glad you did that. I didn't even think about doing it. But whenever you're looking at these laws and you're struggling with one, go to those around it, because God's law is not arbitrary. There's reasons why they're placed where they're placed and why they're not placed in other places. Anybody else over here? Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. So they put him in custody. And the Lord said to Moses, they wouldn't know what to be done with him.
Uh-huh.
And the Lord said mm-hmm. to Moses, the man shall be put to death. So if God tells you, it's time to take that guy out.
Huge difference between Moses and everybody else on the planet. You know what that difference was? It's called the tabernacle. And Moses went into the tabernacle, and guess who was inside? Literally, the angel of the Lord was inside there. Remember, Joshua was outside and he heard him talking? This is not whispers in Moses' ears. This is not Moses the crazy man making up laws because he needed to civilize these crazy people. Literally, God said this, and he saw him, and he heard him. And so he did what he said. Nobody else has that prerogative that I'm aware of, but usually we call those people cult leaders. And they drink a lot of Kool-Aid and die. Right.
Like, I don't think they brought him to Moses thinking God's going to say kill him. Has that law been delivered yet? Anything regarding regarding like death for violating the Sabbath before now?
It's a great question. When we're in the book of Numbers, off the top of my head, I can't think of one. We certainly have had the death penalty many times that's been given, but just not in this instance. Uh-huh.
It's also interesting what comes after, which is the one about the blue fringe or the blue tassels, so that you can be reminded moment by moment to be in the Lord and to obey the commandments of the Lord and to do them and to not follow after your own heart or your own eyes, which you're inclined to whore after, so that you shall remember to do all my commandments. So that's interesting that that comes right after.
Let's think about that law that comes right after. Wearing tassels on your garments. Who was required to do this in Israel? Anyone else? I think that's talking to everybody, isn't it? The people of Israel. So, there are specific occasions where a priest had to wear something specific like that. That would be a ceremonial law. But interestingly, what would you call this?
It's almost moral. It's like keeping your eyes on the Lord. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul and all your mind.
I would say that it's very deeply moral with a specific civil implication in that culture. Which would be the tassel. So, don't accuse me of being a Roman Catholic, because I'm not meaning it that way. But why do people do the rosary?
To remind them.
Mm-hmm. In its best sense, that's what it is. Obviously, you can turn anything into an idol if you want to. But I have a feeling that there might be a moral principle that's behind the rosary that's a good moral principle in its best sense.
Well, this would be like today for us. It might be like putting note cards with verses around, so when you're brushing your teeth, you read a verse.
Or little signs on your wall in your house.
Yes.
Right? That people do that all the time. That's the evangelical equivalent of this. If it's an evangelical equivalent, then guess what? I think that means that there's a moral principle there that's eternal. And if you're able to understand the moral principle, then you're able to go, okay, if it's a moral principle, then it's a good principle. And there could be ways that are neutral of carrying out that law today. That doesn't mean that I have to put a tassel on the top, you know, and wear it off of the string of my head or something like that, because I'm trying to be an Israelite living in the 13th century BC. Yeah.
I'm trying to keep all this together. I'm trying to get to that undergirding principle of life. Behind civil, ceremonial, and moral laws. And we have in this society a saying of locking somebody up and throwing away the key, which would say his life is forfeit. Okay? To go back to that issue of beating somebody with lashes or not going beyond a certain point. I remember a case, this is a couple of decades ago, some kid in China, an American in China, was found guilty of keying somebody's car, and the penalty they gave him was to be beaten with rod so many times. Some of you might remember. But there was a big brouhaha about, you know, this is an American kid, and you're not going to beat this kid. I don't know whose kid he was, but... the concern in China was, why not just beat the kid and let him go on with his life, you know, just get this over with. But instead, he's in custody all these days while the authorities are trying to figure out, you know, whose laws apply. And I think they ultimately wind up just beating them and just say, you guys do what you want with them after that. Again, get back to the life component. In that society, they were saying, you know, the kid's life is a forfeit for what he did. You know, here's the consequence in our society. We're going to just do this, and then his life is his own. And what he makes out of it is his own. But you're asking us to tie his life up. This is the idea that Eli came up with. You're asking us to take so many months or years off his life for X, Y, or Z, and we say, just beat him and let him go on.
Yeah.
To take it to this last business that we just bring up now, they asked God, Moses asked God, what should be done with this guy? And the answer is, his life is full. Here's what I'm getting out of all this. Life is for God to give and to take away. And to the extent that any government executes somebody, it has to be as a consequence of following God's desires in the matter, and not just, you know, going overboard with their own sense of civility.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Eric?
I want to disagree with that. I think that is the right way that it should be, but I think many governments take away life willy-nilly without following those procedures, and that's why we're not drawn to that, because it's unjust. And I think you're pointing to justice, which is God's law.
Isn't it interesting that you have two cultures, and our culture is this democracy and all about our freedom and everything else. And so one of our guys goes over to their country, and he now literally went under their rules, and we're like, nope, you don't have the right to carry out your rules on our guy. That's so American. It's just so unbelievably American. Like, you forfeited your right to that by going to their country. And it's interesting, because if you're a non-Christian and you come to the church, you don't have the right to get here and say what God can do in his church and what he can't. This is his kingdom, his rules, his laws, and our job is to carry them out. But no, that's not what we think anymore, because it's a democracy. So we're going to change all of God's laws in the church and make them fit what our own specific circumstances are in the 21st century in 2023. It's such an interesting dynamic.
Thinking about interpretational principles, this tassel thing, is there, how do you know whether to take that literally or figuratively? And the reason I ask is because there's somewhere else that talks about putting the law on the forehead, and then the Pharisees boxes with fragments in it on the forehead. That was sometimes kind of an idiotic interpretation that's obviously meant to be figurative and not literal. And yet, I read this, and my mind went to literal.
Okay, so, yeah.
So is there
my number one logical fallacy is never create an either or. We do that all the time. All the time. We do this with 666, because 666 is, in Revelation, it's coming from the whole idea of stamping it on your forehead or your right hand, right? From the little phylacteries that they had. And so we go both ways. So you read the commentaries, and one's like, well, it's just a spiritual number, and if you have Jesus, you know, in your heart, then you don't have 666. And the other guys are like, no, they're going to come with a barcode, and they're going to stamp it into our hand. And so it's like, why does it have to be this either or?
So by answering that way, though, you're pretty much saying figurative is allowed.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Figurative is necessitated because it's a moral principle. But what I'm saying is, can the moral principle be helped through a literal carrying out of it in a physical way?
But back to your original question. The original question was, well, what type of law is this? If it's figurative, I'd say it's moral. Because it's talking.
If it's purely figurative, yes. If it's purely figurative.
If it's the tassels are supposed to be worn, that sounds all civil, because that's kind of a very unique.
And this is exactly my point, Dave, is that law, in my opinion, would be a civil law for the theocracy of Israel, for all the people to carry it out based on a moral principle that can go through all generations and all time. But God is not commanding his church to go and everybody has to buy little phylacteries and start wearing them all over their bodies now. And if you don't do that, you're not a true Christian. Like, yeah, I know. They do. Like, but to impose that upon the whole church is, I think that's exactly what Paul's talking about in Romans 14 sorts of things.
So they, in Israel at this time, it wasn't breaking the law to probably not have these tassels.
I can't answer that. I don't know. Because I don't see it. Is there a law that says thou must wear a tassel? Like, yeah, yeah. There's so much ambiguity with those kinds of questions. We just don't know. Well, he's not saying, Albert, let's be clear. He's not saying that everybody needs this. He's saying it's going to happen, period. There's nothing you're going to do to stop it. So let's get ahead of it, for right or for wrong. But yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah, Rick?
Isn't it a difficulty? I don't know how this would be answered. If we have a conscience of the people around us, I picture what if Lafayette and Boulder humbled himself under God and said, let's go ask these elders over here. Can we execute criminals? Can we do this? It doesn't it raise a question like Pete brought up? We've departed from a certain thing where we believe Proverbs was not being theonomy minded to chasing your children with a rod. So it creates more questions that maybe.
Well, let's just stop right there, because if somebody's going to come from Lafayette, there's two ways you could do this. If leadership comes and they have the power to create a law and they want to come and ask our church, what do you think about that? I'm going to give you my opinion. But if they're, I don't have any power to create a law. So unless that's what the case is, then it doesn't really matter what I think.
But they do, don't they? And they want to come.
Well, they might.
Well, they want a good conscience like we all
let's, do. Yeah, we're hoping. Especially Lafayette.
Woo. I'm just saying that they did.
Crazy train over there. I'm just saying that they did. All right, we will continue this next time, and there's a lot more to look at.